welcome to Nipton Talks. I'm your host, Dr. Ashley Roby, and with me is Dr. Kelly Killeen. So Dr. Killeen and I, we're going to talk a little bit about the Wild West of plastic surgery, starting from things like med spa interactions, providers, whether it's someone who is or isn't qualified, and the right kind of provider that you may want for actually doing surgeries. So to start off, unregulated plastic surgery and aesthetic surgery is definitely a problem that is going on, not just in the United States, but worldwide. The number of people that are interested in plastic surgery procedures and surgeries is going up, and also the number of people willing to perform them, whether it's an esthetician or a doctor, or not a doctor in some cases, is going up as well. So we just wanted to tackle some of the pitfalls that can be associated with the aesthetic and plastic surgery world, things like procedural med spa treatments all the way up through surgery. Starting with the procedural perspective, so things that you would do in med spas, one thing that I think is interesting, Dr. Killeen, is that a lot of people don't really realize that the directors of medical spas don't necessarily have to even be plastic surgeons. They don't have to have an expertise in aesthetics. Does that surprise you?
It doesn't surprise me, but yeah, I mean, I think people just honestly have no idea. And then I just saw there was an article published in one of the dermatology journals, and I think 81% of med spas, the medical director is not a plastic surgeon or a dermatologist. And two-thirds of them don't have a doctor on site. So only one-third of med spas actually have a physician on site. And most of those physicians that are on site aren't even the right type of physician, which is really scary for patients.
It is scary because the role of a supervisor is to be looking over the people underneath you and providing commentary, feedback as to what is a safe practice, what's the ideal way to do this. But if you have the supervisor essentially never there and also wouldn't know what they're commenting on even if they were there, it's definitely a setup for potential dangers and failures and for people to get hurt.
Absolutely.
I was looking at lots of cases all over the news. You and I talked a little bit about the HIV cases that were being transmitted.
Right.
That was in a salon in Albuquerque, New Mexico, where the providers, essentially they don't have really much in the way of medical experience, were doing injections at a, I think it was primarily like a hair spa, but they also did some little side aesthetic treatments. But if you don't know how to properly dispose of or care for needles, and people maybe think you can just, I don't know, rinse them off with alcohol, and I don't know.
Right. I mean, I did a TikTok about this and I can't remember the exact numbers, but for people that don't know, the cost of the tip on a microneedling device is about $100 for most of the ones on the market in the United States. And the cost for the PRP tube is at least $100 in the United States. So if you're paying less than $200 for a microneedling treatment, you're probably getting something that has been used more than once. And when we're talking about bloodborne illness, this is actually terrifying. And this is a great example of what can happen. So in that salon, HIV was passed and transmitted to multiple patients. And the prices that people were paying for microneedling with PRP treatment at that salon was less than $150, as I recall. So less than the cost of goods. So
yeah, that's
obviously,
right.
You know, this is going to be shifty. Like at a baseline, things are not going to be done properly if you're not even covering the cost of goods there.
Yeah, that's right. They were advertising vampire facials. I don't know what other services they offered, and I'm not sure if it was just the vampire facial related treatments, but they did do a genetic evaluation of the actual viral serotype, and they said that it seemed like all of those cases seemed to be related. So it wasn't bad luck. It probably was one person. They're reusing their needles, and they're just transmitting it. The HIV virus can last, I want to say it was like 42, 48 days on a needle. So they're just reusing it. And that's obviously life-changing for people and wouldn't be worth it.
Well, whenever people comment to me and try to argue with me in my social media about this type of stuff, they always say, I did a training course, I'm certified, I'm trained. But what they fail to recognize is that the training to do procedures isn't just learning to do that specific procedure. You know, you need to learn anatomy, physiology, and just general medical care, but you also need to learn how to deal with bloodborne pathogens, how to deal with needles safely.
Complications of those procedures.
Yeah, I think that, you know, people don't understand. It's not as simple as just learning, like, to pick up a microneedling device and go like this. Like, anybody, my child could do that. Like, anybody can do that. That's not the point, though. You know, knowing when to do it and how to do it safely and how to manage problems is not something you can learn at a course. And that's the thing that's really scary about med spas, is that there's no formal training, standardized certifications for people other than dermatologists and plastic surgeons with this stuff. There's just not. So you just never know what you're going to get when you walk into a med spa when there's not a medical director that's a plastic surgeon or a dermatologist.
Right. So you and I both are affiliated with med spas, but it's ones that we are actually affiliated with. So it's not to say that we think that every med spa is suspicious or dangerous. That's definitely not the case. But from the perspective of the patient or the end consumer, you really have to know who it is you're seeing, who's supervising the facility, and what their role is. Most healthcare providers, statistically, that are supervising facilities often supervise more than one, sometimes many, many. So right. Not only are they potentially not even in that same appropriate line of field, but they're never there. And even if they were, percentage-wise, they could only be there a slim amount of time. Every state has different laws and regulations. California is more strict than Indiana. Indiana's
very strict. And it's interesting in California because a lot of the strictness has to do with the power of the nursing board. So the nursing board has very aggressively lobbied to limit other people doing things. And so, you know, estheticians are not allowed to do things. They're very strict with LVNs. And, you know, in some ways it's bad, but other ways it's good.
I agree. I think it's mixed. In Indiana, estheticians can do injections. That's not the case, I know, in other states, probably California, one of them included. But in Indiana, just because someone is an esthetician, that's not a baseline part of their training, injections. But that's also true for nurses, you know? It's not like part of an RN degree is learning how to do Botox or filler. So regardless of
there's no training program. I hear a lot like, I'm an aesthetics MP or I'm an aesthetics PA, I'm an aesthetics RN. There's no training program for that. So doing some non-structured, non-standardized on-the-job training doesn't make you that type, like a subspecialist, like it does in medicine. You know, in medicine, you do a medical doctorate, which covers general care, and then you subspecialize afterwards with a many-year residency. And then on top of that, you get your board certification, which you maintain, and you have to prove a certain number of hours of dedicated CMEs or continuing medical education credits. And part of those credits are in patient safety, and then part of them are in your actual field. But they don't have that in nursing.
I think they do have some they have some CME stuff.
They have CME,
but not the same rigorous training. Yeah, absolutely.
They're not doing a patient safety and an aesthetic CME. They didn't have a formal training. There was no formal amount of hours. You know, a lot of people who hang a shingle up have zero clinical training and haven't done any of this other than an Allergan course where they went and learned how to inject for a few hours. And I think it's really problematic. We should have some type of standardized training where you have to do a certain amount of things to be called something, and then you have to maintain that skill set just like physicians do.
Absolutely. And that gets us into our next subtopic is unqualified providers doing medical procedures. So that can be like that case in Indiana where we had the two nurse practitioners that were doing liposuction. So never, as far as I'm aware, are nurse practitioners ever qualified to do liposuction. The semi-funny thing about that was they were really proud of their liposuction case and they posted it on Instagram or some kind of social media. And the negative feedback was immediately pretty profound, where people are commenting like, oh my gosh, I thought this was supposed to be sterile, and you're touching the towel on the bed that's not sterile, then touching the patient, then touching the instrument, and then touching other things that are not sterile. This particular incident in Indiana with the two nurse practitioners and their supervising provider was a pathologist who wasn't even on site. So it's kind of scary.
He's not trained in living patients. So, I mean,
yeah, exactly.
There's also the one who's got a big social media following, who's a PA, and he's in Las Vegas.
Oh, yeah, I looked that up.
Yeah, he has a medical director. Apparently, I can't remember who the prior one was, but the current one is an ER physician who
Yes.
has no surgical training or should not be supervising. I mean, and typically when you would have a PA in the operating with you as a plastic surgeon, I have a PA on my team. They're with you, assisting you. They're not doing an operation without you. But this PA is doing operations without any doctor on site. And it's all on social media, no mask, no sterile gloves, no sterile gowns, no sterile field, you know, constantly contaminating. Watching it is terrifying.
I don't know how it gets away with that.
I don't either. I've spoken to some of my colleagues that are there in Nevada, and people have reported him, and the medical board does not intervene because the rules are often quite vague. And as long as you can show a relationship with the physician, and you have to have, again, the patients complain about you. And that's sometimes the hard part. You have to wait till people have really bad complications, which is unfortunate. And a lot of these procedures, although they're low risk, they do have serious complications, but the complications that patients are suffering under him are typically aesthetic complications. And people are less likely to report those things than life-altering things that end you up in an emergency room or in a hospital or ICU somewhere.
What about perforated bowel, et cetera? You're right. His current supervising provider is an emergency room physician, but the previous one was like a cardiovascular medicine specialist. So again, not an upgrade.
Yeah, and again, like you said, I mean, I don't want to disparage patients because people are just, they often don't know.
I think they're just trusting, right? I think people believe that this person is a proclaimed expert.
You would hope that people wouldn't do things that are unsafe and unethical, but the results that are posted by this person are like the worst liposuction results I've seen. They're the type of things that we would see in our meetings where people would be like difficult case conferences where you would say, how do we fix this? Like, this is hard to fix. And those are the results. And he shows a lot of patients with really significant penises. And he says over and over again on his social
media, the skin shrinks down.
I can do things no one else will do. No one would lipo this. And it's like, well, yeah, because it's the wrong thing to do. You know, it's the social media, just my office went down that rabbit hole. My PA and my MP were like, oh my God, on his website. No formal befores and afters. It's all just patient selfies, half of them filtered. He has the patients under their government names as their before and after, or their screen names on social media. I mean, that whole thing is wild, but people are signing up for it.
But also the approach is funny too. It's like step one is a phone call. Step two, schedule surgery. Step three, book your flight. Woo! It's a very aggressive and unusual approach to deciding how someone, or if someone is a candidate. That's similar to Sono Bello. That kind of approach. So Sono Bello, for those of you that don't know, is essentially a chain liposuction plastic surgery provider in the United States. I don't know if they're in other countries or not. I think primarily the US. They do have some board certified plastic surgeons, but they also have cosmetic surgeons on staff. But their approach as far as how people are evaluated and seen, I think, is similar to this. Like, you're calling and talking to someone, and they give you a plan, even though it's not the surgeon. And then you come in and you meet the surgeon the morning of, and you have your surgery, and see you later.
Right. I mean, it's a chain liposuction site. There's several of them. The two other ones that are big are Elite Body Sculpture and AirSculpt, which is, I think, Elite's turning into that. And they just have slick marketing, but they're just a lipo chop shop. So they don't have an operating room. You know, they have procedure rooms that aren't like accredited operating rooms. You don't have anesthesia. And the sales are typically done mostly by like front desk or kind of patient coordinator type staff. A lot of them, you don't meet your doctor to the day of the procedure. They don't have a lot of standards for who the doctor is. You know, I have, like I said, I don't feel good about those places. I know that there's board certified plastic surgeons. It's very common early in your career when you're building a private practice and you're trying to build up your own book of business, that people will contract with them. I just got an email from one of them, and they're recruiting. And I mean, the recruiting, it was amazing. It was just exactly what you would expect. It was like,
we will give you a Mercedes.
$400,000 a year, no call, no weekends. And I see that and I'm like, who's taking care of your problems? Because everybody has calls on nights and weekends when you're a surgeon, no matter what you do. Because I think you and I both know that all their calls and problems go to the ER because they're not, I don't think it's the right thing to do. And then the person that started Elite and AirSculpt is actually in my neighborhood. I think he actually parks in my parking garage, and he is not a surgeon at all. He completed no residency program, from what I can tell. It's like nearly impossible to find information online about him, but he has like a year here, a year here, a year here in like three different fields, like psychiatry. I think he did 1 year.
He's a doctor or has an MD.
Yeah, and that's who started it. And AirSculpt's the funniest one because, you know, that big influencer did it, and that was kind of, she was pushing it that it was like amazing. They say scalpel-less, but they use punch biopsies to make their incision. I know.
Yeah.
Which heal not as nice as a straight line, but, you know, I digress. And there's been a lot of stuff behind the scenes, and I don't want to out anyone because I know they have non-disclosures, but let's just say that there's nothing really special about their equipment. It's just power-assisted liposuction. And it's just, it's fascinating to me how some of these people are just really, really good at marketing, and patients are paying as much for those places as they would for a plastic surgeon in their office when they get substandard care, in my
opinion. So I don't know what it is. I think that they might be a little bit cheaper. And also, I don't know if it's just the streamlined approach that is an appeal for people that are like, I want to do it and I want to do it now. Yeah. But I've seen some pretty weird results. I mean, I know some people get good results because I think they do have some good surgeons, but it's a little bit of a luck of the draw. Like, you don't know who it's going to be, and you don't know if they're good or not.
You're not choosing the surgeon. And whenever you're choosing a procedure,
you're choosing a price.
Right. The proceduralist should be who you're going to. You're not looking at the results of the group. You're looking at the results of that person who does it. And, you know, you might be assigned to someone who is not necessarily who you would want to be doing a procedure on you. And then when you only sell one thing, it's like I always say it, if your only tool is a hammer, everything looks like a nail. And so you just may not be getting the right procedure. And I think that's really important for patients to recognize. You know, the whole Burger King fast food type of plastic surgery practice where you drive in, you order what you want and get it is not what you want. You want to drive in and have a medical professional tell you, based off of what your goals are, what the best option is. And that's not what you get at those places.
Yeah, I mean, you're right. So step one is you have a salesperson essentially providing recommendations for your surgery. So that's the first problem. The second problem, you don't meet the surgeon until the day of. And I will say some of the results I've seen are weird. Like, for example, they do some skin excisional procedures. I don't think like a traditional abdominoplasty, but I saw a tummy tuck and the patient had the incision at the bottom and incision on the belly button, but then it also went above and below. Like, what is this above the belly button nonsense? Like, what?
That was just the body version of the lifestyle lift.
No, it's like, there's, awful. For those that don't know why I'm so shocked, is because with a tummy tuck, you put an incision on the belly button, you pull it down. So in no scenario, because they're not doing a fleur-de-lis, so other than that, should you have an incision extending above the belly button?
No.
So
never.
So this,
I mean,
poor,
it's just
weird.
Know what they're doing.
That's so scary.
It's really scary, and they're doing it under local. I had a patient actually who I ended up operating on, or who was booked with them on my block. And her friend had recommended them because they went there, and she said she just had, you know, bad sales vibes. Like, she felt like she was walking into a makeup counter and they were just trying to upsell her 14 products. And she's like, I don't want to be part of this.
Yeah.
So luckily she escaped it. But yeah, I don't know what goes on there. It's not for me.
It's not good. And some things you just can't undo. I mean, you can camouflage, you can improve them. But if someone's created this crazy, weird scar that shouldn't ever have been there in the first place, you can make it better, but you can't make it gone. You can't make it go away.
Bad lipo is one of the most challenging problems in plastic surgery. Having a bad result from liposuction is nearly an impossible problem to solve, and I don't think people understand that. A lot of the things you'll see online with people solving it, it's just they'll show you immediately afterwards when the patient's swollen and it looks like the contour problems are gone, but they come right back as soon as the swelling goes down, especially when you convert bad abdominal lipo to a tummy tuck. And it can be devastating and really alter your life. If you're someone who is out and active, I mean, it can show through your clothing, it's so bad. So it seems like a small procedure, but it can have pretty significant life-altering cosmetic changes.
Yeah, it can be tough to fix, and oftentimes you're doing micro liposuction or skin removal or micro fat transfers.
Yeah.
fat transfer is just to camouflage. It's tough.
Revisions are always much, much more expensive than the primary surgery, so it's worth getting it done right the first time.
Yeah. That leads us to the other part, which is non-plastic surgeons performing plastic surgery. So this can be a whole range of things from what we were talking about before, which are like NP levels, which I think is pretty uncommon. You don't see a lot of people.
Yeah, there's not a lot of that.
That's pretty sensational and shocking. But there is more of people just trying to kind of push the boundaries of their scope of practice. And I feel like that is really common. In fact, there's one plastic surgeon here in town who's, like me, is ENT and facial plastics, but also I'm board certified in plastic surgery. They are not, but they do breast surgery, breast augs, tummy tucks. And so, you know, for this person, like, what's your training in that?
No, I mean, you've had no formal training below here. Someone that would take risk with someone's life without proper training is such a wild thing to me. I mean, we would never do that. You know, it's for money. They do it because they want to make money off of patients and they don't care about your safety. And then they'll say things like they have a special interest in whatever. Well, then do the proper training.
So your patients are
safe. You know, people who care about their patients do all of the things to keep their patients safe. And people who don't. And so if you are doing things outside of your scope and training, you know, also those people are not subject to the same rules and things that our societies and boards subject us to. They're more likely to be unethical in my experience. They're harder to vet because they don't need to do the same things we do when it comes to reporting and what type of facilities we work at. It's just, you get yourself into a whole world of trouble as a patient when you start dabbling into a world of in an unregulated industry in plastic surgery. You want to work with people that are being watched because you know that they're doing everything right because they're being watched.
Yes, and I think that in general is the case. For patients, it's hard to know because this person, you know, they tout themselves as having multiple board certifications that would qualify them to do the things they do, but when you look at it, they don't. That also reminded me of the PA we were talking about in Vegas. The other thing that made me laugh on the website was something about you could win free liposuction.
We would never be, that's not.
We can't do that.
That's not, you would lose your board certification. You would be kicked out of ASPS. Like that is something that you cannot.
You can't give away, right. And I tried to click on that button and it didn't go anywhere. I'm like, damn, I'm going to win this free liposuction. No, it's not a thing.
Yeah, I find it so interesting. I mean, I did 8 years of postgraduate training. So I was a resident for 8 solid years. I performed thousands and thousands and thousands of cases. And I think all of us remember those first couple weeks when you're all of a sudden alone as an attending and you no longer have the support, even though you were doing big bad operations on your team. The first time you're alone, even the smallest procedures, you feel the weight on your shoulders as you do it because you know all of the things you know that this can go horribly wrong. And now it's you. You're the ultimate authority. And I think the scary thing is that these people never feel that way. They never respect any of the procedures the way we do. When you've seen really, really tiny things have horrible outcomes, you have a respect for surgery that people who don't train in it don't. You know, we've seen the people that get malignant hyperthermia after a breast aug and end up in an ICU. You know, we've seen the people that have anaphylactic reactions suddenly to an antibiotic that are a healthy 20-year-old. We've seen people get
the pus out implants, right?
Or pus out implants. I mean, we've seen all of these things, and we know that although it goes right a lot of the time, sometimes it doesn't. And the difference between it being a problem that's solvable, that leaves the patient not maimed with their life, and having the opposite happen is a very small margin of error. And those are things you just can't learn unless you do it for many, many years and treat thousands of patients. You just can't.
I agree. And so when we talk about plastic surgeons versus cosmetic surgeons, I think that's a common misunderstanding that those in the eyes of the average person are very much equivalent. When in fact they're not.
They're not. I mean, they couldn't get in the front door, so they snuck in the back. And I think that's the way to consider cosmetic surgeons. Anybody that cares about aesthetics and wants to do this type of surgery, they do the formal training programs, but they're very, very competitive. And so a lot of people cannot do it. And that's the reality. And so they sneak in the back door without proper training. So you have people that may not have been ever qualified to get in the first place, and now they're doing it without proper training, which is even scarier.
Exactly. And the American Board of Cosmetic Surgery is not recognized by the American Board of Medical Examiners or by the American Council for Graduate Medical Education. So they're not equivalent. I think that people that hold that certification would like to think they were, they would like to advertise that they were, but the level of training between those two board certifications is just so vastly different. Like, for example, I had some recruiter send me some information about, oh, do you want to hire these plastic surgeons? I looked at them, not a plastic surgeon, cosmetic surgeon. No, delete. No.
Yeah. Not interested.
Yeah.
It's funny. They've tried to clean things up in recent years. And so they claim now that you can only get board certified if you do an actual fellowship. And remember, these are non-standardized, non-accredited fellowships. So where you're learning from non-experts like GYNs and family practice.
Doing liposuction in their office, probably.
Doing liposuction with no standardization. And then they claim they have criteria. But remember that that crazy woman in Washington who was a family practice doctor, who
yes.
wasn't even boarded in family practice, who was handcuffing her ladies, was not only on the board certified by them, she was like on their board of directors for a while and was teaching courses. So it's just all smoke and mirrors, and it's meant to confuse and make patients believe that they have qualifications they don't. And it's really unfortunate. There are some truth in advertising laws in states, which I always encourage people, if you're listening to this, if you see them, you should support them, that don't allow people to advertise board certifications outside of areas that are recognized, because it would cut down a lot on patients being misled.
In California, I don't think you can say you're board certified as a cosmetic surgeon, right?
That's recognized by the American Board of Medical Specialties. And then there's a couple things that are recognized, but not technically, like
so facial plastics, right? Yeah. So they did get a special designation to say they're ABME, so American Board of Medical Examiners or Specialties, like. I think they're the only one that's like that.
Maybe I think they're the only one too. Oculoplastics might be too. I'm not positive though, but I think the rest of them are not, which is great. The problem in my mind is that, like, I'm always a patient protection advocate, and I want everyone to be safe. And I don't think anyone can make good decisions without safe, accurate, proper information. And some of these truth in advertising laws really make sure that you as a patient get better information about your doctors and that they can't mislead you.
Oh yeah, speaking of oculoplastics, my understanding was that their zone of expertise was here. But I see them, they're doing stuff here and here. They're really expanding.
A lot of creeping happening in specialties. I mean, OMFS is the same way. When I was in Kansas, there was a very famous OMFS, who, people listening, it's oral and maxillofacial surgeons. So this is a surgeon who did both dentistry and medicine, and then they do a special fellowship in maxillofacial surgery.
So, and like moving jaws forward, moving jaws back, things
right,
like that.
That kind of stuff. Like at OHSU, Ashley and I, we shared facial trauma call with them.
They only took like a quarter.
It took a little bit. And then ENT took some of it too. I mean, we got screwed with call. Plastics got screwed with everything, with hand and with face.
75% hand, 50% face. We did get screwed. Thanks
a
lot.
It's a little bit of a shared specialty, but there was a guy in Oklahoma City who was OMFS who did breast and body work. There's no reason why that should be allowed. I mean, that's insane to me.
So, yeah, so for me, like, I am ENT background, and I would have never have decided, like, hey, I'm just going to do facial plastics training after ENT, but also, really, I'm going to do everything. That's not appropriate. That's not okay. That's not the best for your patients. That's not the best training for you. And I don't understand, I mean, I do, people, for the money, but that's not the right reason why you should be pushing the boundaries of your training and expertise. And it's unfortunate, because I think the average person or patient doesn't really understand the difference.
Right. Well, in facial plastics and plastics, I mean, I think people need to understand too, you know, facial plastics is a true fellowship that happens after ENT, or you can do it from other fields, but it's not common from general surgery, where you just focus on facial aesthetic surgery, right? Whereas plastic surgery is a multiple year fellowship, but now it's a full residency. So it's minimum 6 years, where it's integrated the whole six years, versus how Ashley and I did it as a true fellowship, but it's longer than facial plastics. So we did facial plastics plus everything else. So I think that, you know, it just depends on what you want to do in your career. If you want to do body, then a true plastics training program is the only place where you learn that in a standardized accredited program.
I agree. Anything short of that is substandard, subpar, and I would not advocate for anyone seeing someone with that training, experience.
Yeah, so. I love my facial plastics. We have the best facial plastics colleagues in town. They're awesome. They stay right in their lane. Like, we stay right in our lane, and patients are safe and get great outcomes.
But here's the thing. The huge overlap between general plastics and facial plastics. They have the same turf. So for me, I do all of the above. But I obviously have experience in both. People could argue, oh, is such and such person better than another person at the nose or a facelift? And it's probably person dependent. But both of those people, a plastic surgeon and a facial plastic surgeon, have the experience and the training to do those kinds of procedures.
Absolutely. And in my environment in LA, everybody wants an expert. So everybody tends to subspecialize into one area. But yeah, I mean, I have friends that are fabulous facial surgeons that are facial plastics, and I have friends that are fabulous facial surgeons that are plastics. So, you know, it just depends on your training and what you end up doing. I don't do a lot of facial plastics anymore. I'm known for breast, and that's what people come to me for. And that's a big, 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 big chunk of my practice now.
Are you doing other body contouring as well?
Yeah, I mean, I do lots of liposuction just because that's kind of married to breast because of fat grafting. And then I do a lot of tummy tucks, and that's probably a majority of what I do these days. I mean, you know, because you and I have both, we're kind of mid-career surgeons. We've been out for over a decade now. And then once you get known for something, that just snowballs, and that becomes more and more and more of what you do.
Sure. I think that's fair. And also, I think we like to promote the things that we like and that we're good at.
True.
So we'll talk a lot about the things that we do all the time, and it's going to lead to the more of the same.
I do miss facial though. My very first job at Kaiser, my first 2 years out, I was at Kaiser, and our Kaiser did not have oculoplastics. And so we did all of the blefs and ectropion and trompia repairs.
I forgot you were there. Okay,
yeah,
okay.
If I had to like choose a facial surgery I miss, I think oculoplastics was probably my favorite of the things that I did. I don't know. There's just something really fun about it. But again, in LA, it's really hard. You know, everybody kind of subspecializes into an area.
So advice for people to help discern and find out the things that matter. For example, whether or not the surgeon is a board certified plastic surgeon, you can go on to the American Board of Plastic Surgery website and literally type in someone's name and look up their certification status. So American Board of Plastic Surgery, which is abplasticsurgery.org. And you can find that. That's easy. You don't have to have a login.
You know, one of my followers turned me on to this site about a year ago, and it's called certificationmatters.org. Mm-hmm. And you can put any doctor in it, and it will tell you their board certification, what it is in. So you don't even have to. Sometimes it can be hard if you don't know what board the person's what their training is in. So like if they aren't a plastic surgeon, like where do you go to see if they're even boarded or what they're trained in? And so the certificationmatters.org is great because it updates real time. And so you can put any doctor in it. It'll go American Board of Family Practice, American Board of Dermatology. It'll tell you exactly what they're boarded in. So that's really easy for patients as well.
Does it include the American Board of Cosmetic Surgery?
It does not. So it's American Board of Medical Specialties, ABMS boards. And so facial plastics won't end up there. So like the facial plastics is hard because people always ask me when I do videos about this, and they're just this, they're a little bit of a gray area, their board and how their board functions. And as the years have gone on, I think it's been recognized to the point, at some point I believe it probably will end up on there, but my understanding is it's still not included on that site or a technically American Board of Medical Specialties board.
Yeah, but well, when I got mine, it was not, but they said they had a special ABMS-like status. So that's a good website, but if your surgeon isn't on there, I think you need to think twice because it's your life, it's your livelihood. These are elective surgeries. It's something that you want to do because you want a good outcome. And I think it deserves a little bit of extra attention on your behalf to make sure that the person that you think is good is actually appropriately qualified to do your surgery.
Yeah, I'll tell this story. One of our girlfriends, you and I don't want to say who it is or where they are because I don't want them to get in trouble with this other person. But we have a friend who, a cosmetic person in town, had some vascular issues after filler injection and didn't know what to do. And this was someone with a lot of certifications, and they were not aware of what to do or were panicking or who knows what. And my friend saw them panicking in a Facebook group asking for, you know, all of the help. And this person ended up getting tons of hyaluronidase and sent to hyperbaric. and all of the things and was able to save this woman's face. And like literally no credit was given, did not pay her for her hyaluronidase. And that's kind of most plastic surgeons' experience with these people. They depend on us when there's problems, these med spas, but they don't have formal relationships with us because they financially don't want to lose money.
That's insane. So this person went to a Facebook group and was like, I have someone whose face is turned white for vascular reasons, help.
Yeah.
Yikes. Yep. That's awful.
Someone with a whole lot of certifications and impressive sounding credentials.
They didn't even pay her back for her hyaluronidase?
Apparently not.
Ew.
That would have bothered me as well, because not only did I help you and not charge the patient, it's like, at least pay for the product you use.
Yeah, geez. People are not classy, not cool.
Not classy, not cool.
Oh, one other thing I wanted to touch on with regards to med spas are some of the illegal products. Not illegal, but questionable and unregulated products, because that can come across a lot. Mostly I'm thinking about like fillers and the botulinum toxins. I knew someone who was like, oh, you pay $6.20 for your Botox, whatever per unit, or $6.30, $6.40. It goes up all the time, so I can't keep up. Oh, mine was only like $4. What? They got it in Syria.
Yeah, I always tell people we're a very high volume practice for Botox, but we also, our Allergan also makes implants, and that's what our consignment of our surgery center is. So we get the cheapest pricing in the country. And if you are paying less than $7 a unit for Botox, you are being misled.
I don't know who's even charging $7. That would cover nothing.
It would cover nothing. And the other thing that we're seeing a lot of is people are doing hyaluron pen treatments. Mm-hmm. I did a social media post about this non-medical person who was teaching other non-medical people in Texas to be injectors, and she was teaching them how to use the hyaluron pen, which is not FDA approved.
Right. I was going to say, I didn't think people were using that.
Right. So it's interesting. So if you purchase it out of the country, because you cannot purchase it legally in the United mm-hmm. States, you can use it on yourself. So if you're stupid enough to go buy it somewhere and use it on yourself, you are allowed to be stupid on yourself in the United States, but you cannot be stupid on other people. And they're also using it to inject lipodissolve, which I find comical as well, because lipodissolve also is not FDA approved. And I'm fine with things being non-FDA approved and off-label, because but it has to be off-label is fine. Like there's some things that just shouldn't be done by a non-medical professional, and that is certainly it. And then the other thing they're doing, that this is the shadiest thing everywhere right now, is semaglutide and tirzepatide and injections. There's a huge black market for that stuff. A vast majority of the compounding farm is
in China.
And they are not using actual real ingredients that they should. So people should be really mindful of this. And you know, you have to ask yourself, I love the principle. I think this is a Peloton thing. I love Peloton instructors, but Jess Sims always says, how you do one thing is how you do all things. And I know that's a very common saying, but it's true. If you're willing to be unethical in one area, you're willing to be unethical in all areas. And so you want the people doing life-altering procedures on you to be ethical in all the areas. And if they're using things from an unethical source, they are not that person. And it is not worth a couple saved bucks.
Exactly. Yeah, so what I understand is that a lot of the products that are coming from China are really questionable, the fillers and the Botox. I hadn't heard about the semaglutide and tirzepatide. That's probably just because we use a very reputable compounding pharmacy here in town.
Problem with tirzepatide and semaglutide. So I did like a deep dive on this because I was curious, because my patients were on it and some were having great results and some were having not great results. So if a medication is on shortage, compounding pharmacies are allowed to make it. And so they do have to use FDA approved sources. And the only sources that make tirzepatide and semaglutide are Novo and Eli Lilly, period. So there is literally no one selling the active ingredient. So they're all getting it in one of two ways. Mm-hmm. Way number one is they're buying it as research ingredients, which is not legal, or they're buying it overseas, which is not legal. And then some of them, what they're doing is buying the pens at a higher dose and then emptying the pens and then using the pens to make a lower dose compounded. And that is questionable but allowed. So, you know, you have to be really careful, and people are like, they want it so badly, but you have to ask yourself again, these compounding pharmacies aren't trying to help you, they're trying to make money. So just, you know, remember that. And it's definitely the wild, wild west. And it's only going to get worse now that Zepbound was approved, because the indications for this stuff are going to be getting bigger. And then also the people prescribing it are not experts, right? So they're going to be...
A lot of them aren't. Yeah.
Right. It's just like hormones. The hormone thing scares me too. These pellets, people are popping pellets in left and right, not for no reason. Some of these medications, these hormones can make you feel really good, but they also can be really bad for you.
Yeah, you have to follow up with labs. And we're getting a little bit off topic, but a lot of these people, like the low T, or the people that are specifically advertising for testosterone replacement, because I think that is a big one. They really promote this ultra supra therapeutic level of testosterone that not even like a teenage boy would have. And then they're trying to have a 60 some year old man run around with T levels that high.
Or women.
Yes.
Women with testosterone levels that are four times what they should
exactly. be. Exactly. And they feel good maybe transiently when they start getting a deeper voice, developing thick facial hair. And then you look at their labs, and I'm just wondering, who put you on all this testosterone?
Right, and they don't follow them up. They don't know or care if they have problems. It's all a money-making scheme. They just will provide whatever patients will pay for. And so that's hormone replacement, and that's weight loss medications, and that's Botox and filler. And, you know, these things are awesome, but they are real medical procedures with real potential complications. And people really need to be careful who they're allowing to do these things to them.
You and I are also both running a business, but we're not going to sacrifice patient outcomes and patient safety for the bottom line of the dollar. The challenge for the patient is to figure out who is going to be someone that I can trust my health with. And I'm sure that can be a really difficult task for people, but I'm guessing if you go to a place and it's called lowt.com and you want testosterone and you have a phone call and then you get testosterone in the mail, I don't know. It's almost too quick and easy, right? Like there's more than just a testosterone that you don't just want to check this many labs and be like, my testosterone's low, my PSA is okay, I'm good, because there's a lot of other things going on in the body.
Right.
And I think some of these places become super hyper-focused, and then they lose the concept of the bigger picture, which is the person.
Yeah.
So
I know, and like the weight loss ones are hard too. You know, there's a variety of different weight loss medications, weight loss programs, weight loss surgery, and there's different indications for all of those things. And so if you're going someplace where they only offer one thing, which is semaglutide or tirzepatide injections, then you're only going to be offered that, and that may not be the right choice for you. And I totally understand that these medications are very hot and they're desired heavily right now. But as a physician, I always want what's best and safest for patients, not necessarily what they want, what they come in asking for. The best doctor is a doctor who will tell you no. You always want someone who will tell you no when that's the right thing to tell you. And I think that there's a lot of these med spas, they don't tell people no enough.
Yeah, I think that's the case, not only from a med spa, but from a surgery perspective.
Yeah, for sure.
Like the Kanye West mom, Dondra West, where she had seen several people, and the one or two of the other plastic surgeons had declined her surgery because of her cardiovascular health issues. Her BMI was also like 34-something, so she just wasn't probably health-wise or body size-wise a great candidate for aesthetic plastic surgery. But I tell this patient,
his dad was a good surgeon, you know?
No, I mean, I'm just saying, like, what happened?
No, I'm just saying,
risks happen, yeah.
People make bad decisions when they want proximity to famous people. And I think, you know, I listened to a TikTok, which I totally didn't agree with today, about a creator I follow, and she was talking about celebrities and plastic surgery. And the one thing she got right in it was that people are like, they have access to the best. Why do they end up looking bad? And it's because...
bending the rules.
Yeah, the best will bend the rules because they want proximity to fame. And that is one of the biggest problems with celebrities and plastic surgery in general. Plastic surgeons are not immune to that. No type of person is. People want to be around celebrities, and so they start saying yes too much. I mean, look at Michael Jackson. He had his friggin' dermatologist prescribing him narcotics, and his cardiologist was giving him propofol to play with at home. I mean, people just make horrible decisions because they want proximity to famous people.
And there was the plastic surgeon in Ohio. Did you see the TikTok person?
Dr. Roxy. I did a bunch of stuff about her. Yeah, that's an interesting case, though. You know, she just got annihilated by another article, which was pretty unfair, actually. I think she certainly is problematic, but I think as what usually does when things like this happen, there's a million patients, you know, complaining of things that are like, I was reading all the complaints of these people who have now come out of the woodwork, and it was just normal post-op stuff.
But yeah, if you're more focused on your video as opposed to the surgery.
The thing that would haunt me forever if I was her was that there's video of her looking into the camera answering questions, liposuctioning a patient that ended up that she perforated their bowel multiple times. That's the moment that is, I think.
You took it too far.
I get it. That big following of hers made her a lot of money, but it also destroyed her career.
Yeah. It's scary.
It's very scary. Yeah.
What you were saying before is true. People just find themselves going down this primrose path, right? Like, I'll make this exception for Kanye West's mom, or I'm going to do more videos because people really like it. It's okay if I'm a little bit distracted, and then they're more distracted, and then they're perforating bowels.
Right. Yeah, I don't like the idea of the live surgery. I know people do it. I see some plastic surgeons doing it on TikTok. I don't like that for a few reasons. I don't like being watched. I want to focus and not be concerned about who's watching me and how they're perceiving what I'm doing when I'm operating. And I just think there's no way to do it without your focus being shifted off of what's important. Surgeons operate in conferences sometimes, like in front of groups of people, like we'll do operate, you know, that's a very common thing in the surgery world, teaching surgeons here, there, and everywhere how to do new procedures. But I think it's different when you're working with a group of colleagues who understand surgical etiquette. They know what they're looking at. They know when it's appropriate to ask a question and not. It's just a different scenario. I think at one point she would have over 200,000 people watching her operate. That's wild to me, having, you know, 200,000 lay people.
Eyes looking at you. Yeah.
I mean, I wouldn't want that. I don't know how anyone could concentrate on what they're doing knowing that many people were watching you.
It's a bad scenario, but as social media becomes more and more prevalent and as physicians are compelled to engage more in that, you have to establish this healthy boundary of when is it okay and when is it not okay to be sharing things with people. So
yeah, I've just not shared active surgery stuff. That's not my jam. Like, I'll film maybe something afterwards, you know, some inch. I just kind of answer questions for people. I personally am more comfortable with that. I don't like the idea of filming while I'm supposed to be concentrating on a patient and keeping them safe.
Yeah, no, I agree. Well, thanks, Dr. Colleen. It's always good to hang out with you.
Nice to see you.
So to recap, do your homework. And that's always true for any kind of surgery. What was the name of the website again?
Certificationmatters.org.
Yeah. That's a good one to check. Most med spas have websites. And if it doesn't say who their provider or their supervisor is, which it should, you can call and inquire and do the same kind of search on them.
And always remember that medicine is structured the way it is for a reason, and a physician-led team is really important for patient safety. So although there's independent practice laws that have been passed in some states, remember that there's no formal structured training in aesthetics that would give somebody the ability to independent practice without a medical degree in plastics or dermatology. Yeah. And if there's a problem, you want Ashley and I standing over you. You don't want somebody with less experience.
Yeah, absolutely. And I, you know, and you and I use physician extenders, whether it's NPs and PAs, but we use them appropriately and they are supervised.
I love my NP. I love my PA. They're awesome. And they're so important on my team, but they are not a replacement to me. We all have different jobs and we make patient care better together. We don't replace each other.
Exactly. So cool. Well, thanks everybody.